last investigator I met with was Dr. Matt Ellis. We began our conversation by commenting on one of his research interests, genomic profiling of primary breast cancers.
About 10 years ago, technology developed that allowed us to look at gene activity through the eyes of mRNA levels in cancer cells. And the technology has evolved a lot, but the basic idea here is you can look at and quantify mRNA levels in a variety of different cancers, but in this case, breast cancer, and look for relatedness between tumors. So you would say that tumor X and Y had a similar gene expression pattern and therefore might be in the same class. And this was shown to be the case. And in the first papers, they outlined basically four or five different types of breast cancer, which received labels like luminal A, luminal B, basal-like, HER2, and normal-like, which then entered the research parlance, but not into clinical utility particularly quickly, because there was a variety of methodological problems. So the first thing about intrinsic subtypes is to understand that they're not trained on the clinical information. All they are is defining different tumors that are related to each other. And if you then overlay the clinical data against these gene expression patterns, you see that these different gene expression patterns do associate with different clinical trajectories. And in general, of course, we know that there is one group of tumors that stand out from the others because they have a relatively good clinical outcome, that is luminal A breast cancers. And then, of course, there's a variety of poor prognosis breast cancer subtypes, poor prognosis luminal or luminal B, and then, of course, basal-like, which is usually captured in that ER-negative, HER2-negative population, and then two HER2-positive tumors. So none of this was particularly a surprise, except that there isn't perfect overlap between ER and HER2 and the intrinsic subtypes that perhaps suggests that there is more information in these data analyses than just the standard clinical parameters. So then for clinical implementation, we've had to overcome a variety of different issues. The first is reduction in the gene list. It turns out that developing assays that involve hundreds of analytes, hundreds of genes, is very hard because you have to show robust measurement for each one of the genes. Secondly, we felt, as others did, that being able to measure genes out of paraffin-embedded material was important because that's the standard way these specimens are processed, and also allows you to do retrospective analyses of clinical trials we'd never do again, you know, Taxol versus not, anthracycline versus not. And so we were able to develop, through bioinformatics, sort of boil down the intrinsic subtypes to 50 genes, and then use various techniques to both identify the intrinsic subtypes through those 50 genes, parse that into prognostic information and perhaps predictive information as well, and then finally develop something that's really important, which is called a single sample predictor. So a single sample predictor takes a training set, and within those training sets are, let's call them prototypic samples. This is what a luminal A breast cancer should look like. And then you have a new sample and you compare it against those prototypes and say, this tumor is pretty much like those tumors and pretty much like, obviously has a biostatistical terminology called centroid proximity, but basically it's saying, yeah, this one looks like a giraffe, it has spots, it has a long neck. And another one, you'd say, this is more similar to a basal-like breast cancer. And you can actually come up with metrics of similarity. And then you can use that information to finally come to the clinical test that requires technology even beyond the standard qPCR to measure 50 genes, because even by qPCR, 50 genes is a lot. So we're finally at the stage of a clinical validation program, and we'll be talking a lot more about this at San Antonio when we can actually discuss with the community what the final technologies was we chose.
Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts about the existing assays being used, mainly Oncotype DX as well as MammaPrint? How do you assess the data and the clinical relevance?
Well, I think they're both clinically relevant, but my role, I think, as the clinician in the groups that do this work, is the clinical validity. So what is the clinical decision that you're using this test to tailor? And I think that that's probably clearest with the Oncotype test. But still, when you're running Oncotype test, there's a couple of things that I think still are works in progress. If you have a low-risk result, then clearly the clinical decision is no chemotherapy. But of course, that still needs long-term prospective validation as a decision, because still the security that a low oncotype result will predict excellent prognosis 10 to 15 years is, you know, still something that we need to be 100% sure of. But most physicians are convinced by the retrospective data, and I probably include myself there. But then in the intermediate group, the clinical decision-making is clouded, not quite sure what to do, and the randomized trial should clarify that. And then in the high-risk group, all Oncocyte says is you're high-risk. It doesn't tell you how to treat the high-risk patient. And in addition, high-risk by Oncotype in the node-negative setting means about a 35 or 40% risk of relapse, which still means there's 60% of patients don't relapse. And then in the node-positive setting, a low recurrence score is associated with a 30, 40% relapse rate. So in other words, node-positive patients, it's not really valuable to tell a patient that there's a very low risk of relapse. So because even the low scores are associated with a high relapse risk, as defined by the node-negative population. So it's somewhat confusing, and I think that a lot more prospective trials would need to be done to really understand how to use it.
It seems like there's a lot more emphasis on the response to treatment as opposed to the prognosis. And in those situations you just described, the node-negative situation with a high risk, where you see, even though, as you say, most of these people are not going to develop relapse, you still see a pretty dramatic drop in the risk of relapse within that 30% with chemo. And in the node positive low risk situation, even though, as you say, there's still substantial risk of recurrence, you don't appear to see any benefit of chemo. What do you see in terms of the clinical utility of that?
Well, I think what we need to focus on is the better treatments overall in the higher risk populations, because that's where the morbidity and mortality of the disease is. So I think that, yes, it's true that the Oncotype high recurrence score patients are more chemotherapy responsive, but there's still a huge numbers of deaths in that population. Similarly, it might be true that the node positive low recurrence score patients are not particularly responsive to chemotherapy, but what are you going to replace it with? What are the good ideas from a targeted therapeutics point of view when you tell a node-positive patient that you don't think chemotherapy is going to work? So I think there's a lot of hanging questions that are raised by this way of analyzing patients, and I think that filling the gap with further biomarker research is going to be critical.
Well, certainly there is the practical value of avoiding a therapy that, you know, has a lot of toxicity. Right now, in your own practice outside a protocol setting, are you using, for example, Oncotype or MammaPrint in that manner of either node-negative or node-positive situations?
Well, I never use it in the node-positive population because I think still the data on 8814 is very meager. If you actually look at the numbers of patients in the low-risk group that were analyzed, we're talking about numbers of events that are just in the 20 to 30 range. So if that was a prospective trial to show the non-inferiority of chemotherapy in low recurrence risk node-positive patients, you'd probably need to do a trial with hundreds, perhaps thousands of patients in it. So we still really don't know the chemotherapy value in that setting. So I think a lot of people are a bit leery. I think another thing to recognize, and I think this is a real problem in biomarker research in breast cancer, is whilst Oncotype like to tell us that their test is homogeneous with respect to sampling different parts of the tumor, I actually think that breast cancer are a lot more heterogeneous than we give them credit for. And there's some recent paper, for example, in genome research, identifying some tumors that are polyclonal. That is to say, there are multiple different clones in that tumor. You happen to have sampled one piece of it, and it may have a low recurrence score. But there's quite likely, in some patients, other parts of the tumor that have much higher risk features. And the risk of there being a polyclonal tumor in part relates to the burden of the disease. So node-positive patients, larger tumors, are more likely to be polyclonal than the node-negative smaller tumors.
So has the Oncotype actually been performed on different parts of the same tumor?
Early on, they did reveal some data that they had done on this subject, but I don't think that's something that's been done very thoroughly. You know, say, for example, the nodal disease versus the primary. our own work on full genome sequencing, you know, really underscores polyclonality as a feature of breast cancer. And so, you know, the thing to recognize with all these tests is they are a top-line genomic summary of the piece of tumor that went into the assay. And I think we're going to have to wrestle with the heterogeneity question a lot more deeply before we have really accurate tests.
What about the MammaPrint? Is that something that you're ordering outside a protocol setting?
Not personally. That currently is a prognostic assay. So there, the clinical validity is, strictly speaking, which patient needs nothing, right? Because that's how you'd use a pure, other than local therapy, that's how you'd use a prognostic assay. And I think there aren't very many patients who are considering nothing. Mostly it's based on very small tumors, which you're unlikely to get sufficient frozen material to do a MammaPrint assay. However, you know, one would suspect that with further validation, there may be further uses of the MammaPrint assay. And I know that they're focusing on perhaps identifying a group of patients in whom neoadjuvant chemotherapy might be an indication for MammaPrint. Poor response, for example, might be better off getting early surgery. You know, there's a variety of research uses under consideration, but I think the frozen material requirement is still a bit of a barrier to that test, and I'm sure you'd agree.
Yeah, and that's certainly the message I've gotten speaking to multiple investigators. Let's talk a little bit about endocrine therapy. Can you kind of provide an overview of some of the areas that you see as exciting in terms of development for the future? I kind of get the feeling we've hit a little bit of a lull, but maybe not. Convince me that it's exciting and we're heading somewhere.
Well, my particular twist on endocrine therapy is that the problem stems from the fact that endocrine therapy is chronic maintenance treatment. We don't truly cure many patients with endocrine therapy. We just suppress the disease progression over long periods of time. And that really leads you to two problems, really. One is that it's very hard to maintain high levels of compliance with a chronic maintenance therapy that can exceed 5 years and maybe even more than 10 years is required, with chronic toxicities and quality of life problems. And then the second issue is one of secondary resistance. If you never truly cured the ER-positive patients, you're just suppressing its growth. Events can occur over those long periods of time that lead to resistance, relapse, and death. So we've been taking the approach that we need to combine endocrine therapy with pathway inhibitors that allow the cells to survive and persist despite the estrogen deprivation or the estrogen receptor targeting. And I've come up with the rather obvious and interesting result that targeting the PI3 kinase mutations that are frequent in ER-positive tumors can actually trigger very high levels of cell death in these estrogen-deprived ER-positive tumors. And we're pursuing PI3 kinase inhibitor combinations with endocrine drugs quite aggressively at this point with a variety of pharmaceutical companies. There are AKT inhibitors, direct PI3 kinase inhibitors, and combined PI3 kinase mTOR inhibitors. Interestingly, mTOR inhibitors alone, at least the indirect ones, the rapalogs, don't look very active in this setting, and that might be explained why there's been some only modest results combining mTOR inhibitors with endocrine drugs. They just weren't hitting the pathway at the right place, which in my view is probably best inhibitor of the kinase itself. So finding ways to trigger cell death in ER-positive breast cancers, I think, is a very important principle.
We're hearing a lot about PI3 kinase and its inhibitors. Can you talk a little bit more about the pathway itself? All I've been able to figure out is it's downstream of something, but what does it really mean? What's it really doing? How does it tie into the ER pathway?
Well, those are great questions. So the PI3 kinase pathway is one of those canonical pathways that fill the pages of cancer research journals along with the MAP kinase pathway. It triggers a variety of metabolic events, cell survival events, appears to be very important in hormone receptor positive tumors as a mechanism to respond to metabolic requirements and cell growth signals required in the response to estrogen. For some particular reason, though I don't think we completely understand, mutations in this pathway are very characteristic of ER-positive breast cancer. In our deep sequencing experiments, I'd say as many as 40% of ER-positive breast cancers have mutations in this pathway, and that makes it more common than P53 mutation. So ER-positive tumors appear to be addicted to PI3 kinase signaling, as evidenced by these gain-of-function mutations. I wonder whether it might be something to do with the cyclical nature of the estrogen exposure with the menstrual cycle, in that the breast, like the endometrium, is supposed to regress back to its baseline state at the end of each cycle. But if you have one of these mutations, it may actually prevent those cells from properly regressing, leading to accumulation of populations of ER-positive hormone-dependent cells, which, instead of dying when you take the estrogen away, they actually persist eventually as a breast cancer. So it would take an hour seminar to go through all the ramifications of PI3 kinase signaling. But suffice to say, you know, I think 10 years from now, the targeting this pathway will be every bit as important as targeting the HER2 pathway to breast cancer oncologists.
Now, you did a really interesting study. I think you first presented at San Antonio, ended up getting published in JAMA, interestingly enough. I thought that was pretty cool. Looking at low and high dose estradiol therapy, a little note there from the past, now becoming the present. Can you talk about that work?
So that was also part of the sort of central theme of my work of trying to trick ER-positive breast cancer cells to die, because it's cell death that's so critical in creating patient cures. So this sort of stemmed out of multiple conversations with people, stemming back to my fellowship days with Mark Lipman, actually. And I was always intrigued by this paradoxical treatment. And I was struck by the fact that the historical data on estradiol was positive, in that clearly it was associated with a decent response rate. It clearly was, efficacy speaking, equivalent to tamoxifen in the trial that Jim Ingle did when he was at Hopkins all those years ago. But the problem was toxicity. And then I got to think, well, all these patients with metastatic breast cancer, where the tumor is growing through estrogen deprivation therapy, they've experienced much more profound estrogen deprivation therapy than ever before. And so maybe as a result, you could use a lower dose of estrogen. And then we chose estradiol because it's a generic drug and easy to obtain because of HRT formulations, much easier than the traditional DES. So the package insert dose for Estrace that was published includes an indication for metastatic breast cancer, 30 milligrams in split doses. So just to make it simple, we compared 1 2-milligram tablet TID versus 5 2-milligram tablets TID, randomized phase 2 design, and basically got a pretty striking result. And I treated many of these patients, so, you know, I have a good deal of experience with this treatment. The bottom line was that, yes, the high dose was toxic. It made people feel nauseated. It's difficult to tolerate, a lot of breast tenderness, and we had some serious adverse events, including uncontrolled hypercalcemia, some cardiac issues. But the low dose was extremely well tolerated. Most patients could stay on it. The level of estradiol that you're achieving with the 6 milligrams a day dose is equivalent to mid-menstrual cycles of a non-pregnant woman, right? So you're giving a physiological dose that premenopausal women would experience every month. And we had good responses. And what was most intriguing, and I don't think this has really been demonstrated clearly before, the patients who responded best to estradiol, when they progressed, you could actually retreat them with the aromatase inhibitor that they'd received before, with some patients showing quite clinically significant responses. So you sort of reverse the resistance problem, at least in part. So I think it's a clinically useful thing. Tips for the practitioners are, patients with bone mets must be on bisphosphonates, because hypercalcemia is a very real problem with this. And if you're not suppressing the hypercalcemia with a bisphosphonate, the patient can develop even lethal hypercalcemia. So always keep them on the bisphosphonate. We excluded patients with a history of venous thrombosis. The flare is very real. When you see flare and they have painful bones, you can stop the drug, let the flare subside, and then just restart at the same dose. And they don't seem to re-flare. And these patients who have flares traditionally, and in actual fact with this low dose, are the patients who benefit most. But do see the patients soon after starting in case they're developing a severe flare that needs management. And that's kind of it. I've had patients been on estradiol therapy for approaching 2 years in some instances with good control of their disease. And it is true the best responders are those with soft tissue metastasis and bone-only disease.
You talked about using AIs after estradiol therapy. Do patients who are coming off AIs respond better or worse to this therapy? And I think about the estrostat theory, which I don't really understand beyond that. Do you see a difference in who responds?
Well, in the protocol, everybody was coming off a period of aromatase inhibition for metastatic breast cancer. Later, we allowed patients to receive tamoxifen in sequence with the aromatase inhibitor, because of work by Craig Jordan that showed that tamoxifen also sensitized MCF7 cells to estradiol therapy. But there weren't very many in those trials. I think the time in which you choose the estradiol therapy will be different from one patient to another. But certainly after the traditional endocrine cascade, it's a fourth line option and maybe an earlier line option in some patients. And I'm not sure whether that answers your question, but that's kind of my thoughts on the matter. How it works is what everyone asked me. We study this a bit in the lab. I think one of the intriguing things about the estrogen receptor is it often continues to be expressed at high level in these resistant patients. You know, like the androgen receptor is expressed at high levels in patients with androgen refractory prostate cancer. And now we know they're not actually androgen refractory at all. You just need a better drug, you know, to attack the androgen receptor and you can get further responses. In respect to the estrogen receptor, it develops this curious biology of ligand-independent transcriptional activation. In other words, it doesn't seem to care about estradiol anymore. It's just active constitutively without ligand. And then when you introduce ligand back in that situation, it produces a toxic event. We still don't understand exactly how that works, but I think it's something to do with this ligand-independent activation switching back to ligand-dependent is a sort of backflip that the tumor doesn't like, and it creates toxicity.
Where are we right now with the agent fulvestrant? You've been part of research looking at it at a higher dose. Can you summarize those data sets and where we are moving forward with this drug?
Right. Well, there are a couple of trials. One trial I was involved in, which was a phase 2 trial comparing anastrozole with fulvestrant, where the fulvestrant was obviously given at 500, not 250. And then there was a trial in the second line setting where they compared two doses of fulvestrant, the lower and the higher dose. And both those trials are suggesting that the higher dose is a little bit more active, which is no surprise to anyone. I mean, everyone understood this was a hard drug to give. The formulation is a little strange. It has to be an intragluteal injection. And there was evidence of the dose response curve from the sort of 125 to 250. So going from 250 to 500, there appears to be more clinical benefit. And I think the conundrum is they probably, in retrospect, should have done a phase 3 trial comparing anastrozole with fulvestrant so that they could file the higher dose. And they may actually be able to file the higher dose on what they have already, but it may be they'll may get some kind of approval that requires another trial of high-dose fulvestrant versus anastrozole. One thing I would say moving forward is I still think that fulvestrant is a good partner for combination therapy. So the paper we just submitted, in the second-line setting, inhibiting the ligand-independent ER activation with fulvestrant, which induces the downregulation, and then hitting with a PI3 kinase, looks like a really good treatment. And there you choose the higher dose, right, because you're trying to get the biggest pharmacological effect. So I think we're going to be, depending on how the reimbursement situation goes, I think we'll be using more high-dose fulvestrant, and I think we'll be looking at fulvestrant in combination with a variety of signal transduction inhibitors, including PI3 kinase.
How do you approach the dosing of fulvestrant right now in your practice outside a protocol setting?
I've looked at the data carefully. I'm not convinced the loading dose makes any difference because the curves don't break in favor of the higher dose until 2 or 3 months. And I think that basically it becomes just going ahead and giving them 500 on day one and 500 on day 29 and not bringing them back for that extra dose at 14 days. I think that that probably doesn't make a difference. But maybe others will argue. But it's certainly straightforward to give it once a month in both buttocks. And the patients seem to have a good tolerance to it. It doesn't seem to be of the things we do to metastatic breast cancer patients, put it that way, this is not particularly significant.
And no problems in terms of reimbursements for the 500 milligram dose?
Oh, no, I think that there is a problem with reimbursement of the 500 milligram dose. I know that there's concern about that, and right now we are not giving it unless we have specific permission from the company to give the higher dose.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about your work with the CALGB, both at the Breast Cancer Committee and the Working Group for Correlative Science. Any comments or thoughts about PARP inhibitors, any discussions within the CALGB in terms of trials looking at these agents?
Well, PARP inhibitors are a fascinating selection of drugs. Those that are available have quite distinct pharmacologies, and they shouldn't be considered as being equivalent. They are quite different. You just have to look at the structures of them to see that they potentially have different clinical properties. Clearly, one class has shown activity in sporadic triple negative breast cancer, which is intriguing. And then another class have shown activity as a single agent in patients who are BRCA gene mutation carriers. And I think the biggest question right now, as I look at this data, is given the heterogeneity of the triple negative subset, what is the PARP inhibitor sensitive subpopulation of triple negative disease? Is there a role for PARP inhibitors in other types of breast cancer? Is homologous recombination defects required for PARP sensitivity? These are all great questions that we'll be focusing on. And there are PARP inhibitor neoadjuvant studies that are being proposed right now, and we'll see light of day quite soon. So I think a variety of PARP inhibitors will get into the early stage setting, but I suspect mostly in the neoadjuvant setting, but also perhaps in the chemo-refractory setting where a patient's had a lousy response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy as a sort of salvage regimen. And then thirdly, a lot of research in the BRCA population as to how PARP inhibitors might help them. So, you know, I'm very excited about these drugs, but like with all these drugs that are newly introduced, we really haven't got a clue how to use them.
I wonder if you could comment on the data that's come out, I guess presented at ASCO, looking at bevacizumab, both in the first and second line setting, and what your thoughts are in terms of its use in the non-protocol situation.
You're talking about the ribbon trials.
Right.
Right.
Well, it was, yeah, there was this meta-analysis. But what's the bottom line in terms of how you put together the effect of this agent and its clinical utility, if any?
Well, I think my view of it is that it's chemotherapy. And what I mean by that is if you look at FDA approvals, they traditionally have thought of endocrine drugs for breast cancer as being approvable on the basis of progression-free survival, but not necessarily overall survival. These are low-risk palliative drugs. They're well-tolerated with a modest safety signal, and so progression-free survival is okay. What happened with bevacizumab, we discovered it didn't really have single-agent activity. It was obligatory chemotherapy partner. So in that sense, it is a chemotherapy. And secondly, as we've given more of it, you know, we do see patients running into problems with hypertension, occasionally heart failure, thrombotic events, and even stranger sort of, you know, neurological problems and bleeding. So, you know, it's not a particularly benign drug. And so given the expense and the toxicity profile and the fact that it was only given accelerated approval, not full approval, I think the lack of overall survival data is really a significant problem for the drug. You know, from a clinical research point of view, my concern is that if this drug, it becomes an obligatory drug in all metastatic taxane-containing regimens, for example, in breast cancer, it has to be the control arm. That's really going to make it quite hard moving forward to investigate new drugs, because there's this arm that costs $60,000 a year to administer. And if it's not producing a survival benefit, I'm not sure it's ultimately worth it. I think that the real answer is we need to do more research on bevacizumab and really understand the right population to use it in. My clinical experiments, it's a response accelerator. So for patients who really have visceral crisis, lung and liver disease, who need a response fast, perhaps because their LFTs are going up quickly or they're getting short of breath, bevacizumab-based regimen seems to get them better faster. And I think the data would support that. But, you know, that might be the population you should really focus on to see if there's a survival benefit, because it kind of wouldn't surprise me if that's the population that do. It's just that all these trials that were done in Europe and around the United States included a lot of patients with much more indolent disease and whom death from breast cancer was not a near-term likelihood, and so survival was difficult to show.
Any comments about some of the newer agents? There was a study presented at ASCO looking at eribulin, another anti-tubulin agent. Any comments about that or any other agents coming along?
Well, eribulin, exabepalone, Taxotere, Taxol, vincristine, navalbine, vinblastine. I mean, we've been using various ways to inhibit the mitotic spindle since you and I were in shorts. You know, so I think the thing is about the mitotic spindle, it's one, complicated. Two, subject to a lot of really interesting gene amplification, somatic mutation events. And so that makes it a really interesting therapeutic target. And I think another new class of drugs that is coming along is so-called kinesin inhibitors. So this is the actual mitotic motor that actually consumes the ATP to drive the chromosomes around the cell. And those are coming on along apparently as well. So I think we should keep studying spindle poisons, in part because when the spindle is prevented from doing its job, it appears to be highly toxic to the cell. So this is killing cancer cells, killing breast cancer cells, and, you know, a good route to increasing the cure rate. So Eribulin, I'm reasonably excited about. I think the data looks reasonably promising for a drug in its class, and I think, you know, it's another drug where there's going to be a lot of active clinical investigation.
Any comments about management of HER2-positive disease, both in the adjuvant advanced disease setting as well as some of the new agents that are coming out?
Well, gosh, there's lots of issues there. I sort of sit on the fence regarding the anthracycline issue. And, you know, the thing about anthracycline and HER2-positive disease is that's probably the group that's most anthracycline-sensitive, right? So I'm a little leery about giving it up. So in younger, fitter patients with good ejection fractions, I'll still use anthracyclines, even in Z1041 in combination with trastuzumab. But any hint of declining or poor ejection fraction, I think Dennis's work on TCH is hugely valuable and makes a great less cardiotoxic approach. With respect to new agents, I'm excited about neratinib. I think it's a very good kinase inhibitor. Hopefully would see the light of day soon. I'm excited by T-DM1, as most people are. And I'm excited by combinations of trastuzumab and kinase inhibitors with other signal transduction agents. And, you know, rapamycin analogs are being looked at there. And in the lab, combinations of HER2 targeting and PI3 kinase targeting look really good. And I think that sort of covers it.
How do you approach the use of anti-HER agents in the metastatic disease setting, outside of protocol setting? Where do you bring in lapatinib? What do you combine it with? Do you use lapatinib and trastuzumab?
Like everybody else, you know, I will use trastuzumab as first line, typically with weekly paclitaxel because of the taxane regimens. That seems to be the best tolerated from the metastatic disease perspective because you can keep going longer and alter the intervals and maintain the patient in remission without too much in the way of those nasty mucocutaneous side effects that some patients with Taxotere often get, although not uniformly so, and there's certainly some patients who seem to do well with Taxotere. But when they progress, I look at the patient, decide whether I want to give them lapatinib capecitabine or continue the trastuzumab and give them lapatinib. And I think it boils down on whether this patient is a good patient for capecitabine therapy. And some patients receive it and find capecitabine very hard, get a lot of diarrhea, a lot of hand-foot syndrome, so maybe that ends up being a patient who's a lapatinib trastuzumab patient. Patients who've got cardiac problems with the trastuzumab, you might choose not to continue the trastuzumab and go to the lapatinib capecitabine regimen. And incidentally, I'm a big fan of the week-on, week-off regimen that the Memorial folks developed. I think it's well-tolerated and seems to be something that's quite useful in combination with lapatinib.
What about in HER2-negative tumors? Is that the way you use capecitabine?
So let me talk to you about my thoughts about capecitabine. I use capecitabine a lot in patients who finally got to the end of my endocrine cascade, which you've gathered is pretty prolonged. I'll try endocrine drugs until I'm really convinced they're refractory, and then I'll go to capecitabine. And I find the response rate extremely high to capecitabine in that circumstances. I'm thinking about finding a fellow to research our capecitabine response rate in hormone refractory ER-positive disease. But I bet you it's 60 to 80% of experiencing clinical benefit. I do that all the time. I use the week-on, week-off schedule. Patients do pretty well with it. But then when they progress, what do you do next? And in fact, of late, I've given a lot of metronomic therapy with cyclophosphamide methotrexate. So this is 50 milligrams of cyclophosphamide daily, and then methotrexate 5 milligrams BID Monday and Tuesday. And I've had some really nice results with that too. So for the ER-positive HER2-negative subset, I use a lot of oral chemotherapy and really only go to IV chemotherapy very late in the game. For the ER-negative HER2-negative patients, it's chemotherapy and I do what everyone else does. That's probably the place where I've used a lot of bevacizumab, a very aggressive disease, a lot of visceral crisis. So the sort of response acceleration you get with the bevacizumab is useful. I use platin and Gemzar like other people there and try to get them on PARP inhibitor trials. But it's tricky right now. The PARP inhibitor trial that is available to people right now is a sort of lottery basis, and that's tough for the patient and tough for the physician trying to get the patient a slot.